Hello, and welcome to the Should I Go See It podcast, where every other Friday we take a deeper dive into the one-sentence reviews on shouldigoseeit.com. This week, we have a special interview with the writer and director of Molly and Max in the Future, Michael Luke Litwack. I'm your host, Bill George, and with me, as always, AJ Rebecki and super producer Craig Stanton.
Hello, fellas.
Gentlemen, how are we doing?
What's going on, Bill?
Not too much, AJ, not too much. What's new with you?
We're going to talk about it in the Netflix and Bill segment, but we wrapped up Masters weekend. Lots to talk about in the golf world.
We'll get to that.
Also, Bruins and Celtics in the playoffs, correct? Yes?
That's right.
That's true. This was a big weekend. Famously, AJ's favorite weekend of the entire year is Masters weekend.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
My favorite weekend of the year, Marathon Monday, or Marathon weekend, Patriots Day weekend, for those of us here in Massachusetts. And those weekends were the same weekend, folks. Which doesn't happen very often.
I was going to ask, does that happen very often? No.
So there was a convergence.
A lot of alcohol was consumed this weekend between Craig and I.
There was a singularity.
Yeah. Well, the marathon, Craig, your wife, our event coordinator, friend of the show, Christine Palazzano, ran it. How'd it go?
You love to see that. Yes, the 128th running of the Boston Marathon occurred this past Monday, and my wife, Christine Palazzano Stanton, that is, Bill.
Touché.
Participated and finished with flying colors. She did great. It was hot. Temperature-wise, I mean. She fucking crushed it. She fucking crushed it. It was great.
Yeah.
Her family came up. We were all hanging out, cheering her on. It was awesome.
That's awesome.
Two things. She had the biggest smile in that picture when she crossed the finish line.
Yes.
Good for her. If I ran 4.5 miles, I would be in a porta potty crying. So she looked amazing. And two, she looked absolutely fucking jacked in that photo. I hope you tell her.
She's been putting in the work. Put in the work.
She's put in the work. She's put in
Hell
the work.
Of a job, KP.
Truly.
We're so proud of you.
Love it. Love it.
On the M theme, Masters Marathon.
Marathon.
We talked in, I don't know, a few months ago during the holidays, my child's hyperfixation was the Grinch movie, the animated one with Benedict Cumberland Farms.
Cumberbatch.
He's now on to Moana. Moana is now his new favorite movie.
Okay.
And he makes me put marker tattoos on himself and me so he can be Maui and then I can be Maui. And he yells at me to sing the song. And then he says that I don't have a ponytail like Moana and then yells at me because I don't have a ponytail like Moana. And it's just a violent, happy time in the family.
So
it's great.
Is your welcome the go-to song? Like that's the favorite song? Or is it the How Far We'll Go or whatever the song is?
Your welcome is definitely. He also likes the Flight of the Conchords crab song,
yep,
Shiny.
Okay, sure. Shiny's going, yep.
And then the coconut song. He calls it the coconut song. When they first get in the village.
I don't remember that one.
The whole village sings. Moana, make way, make way. Moana, if you only knew the village of Motunui. Yeah, it's literally in my fucking brain. So then we do the dances and he has a fun time.
Okay, all right, good for
you. Power of cinema.
Great.
How about you, Bill? You watch anything recently?
You know what I've been doing lately is I went through an audiobook called Nuclear War, A Scenario.
Ooh. Oh,
that's a tone shift.
By Annie Jacobson. And I can tell you, between Oppenheimer, the new show Fallout, and the press from this book, Nuclear War, nukes hot right now.
Have you read the news recently?
Well? Yeah.
It's so hot right now.
Yeah. Well, this book... So Annie Jacobson is a reporter that spent the last couple of years talking to scientists, politicians, military personnel, former military personnel, and she puts together a second-by-second, minute-by-minute account of like what would actually happen if North Korea nuked DC out of the blue. Like if that were to happen, like what would actually go down? Like what are the protocols? What would be the counter attacks? Like what, like how this would actually play out in reality based on evidence and based on like everything we know. Obviously a lot of it's classified and it is absolutely terrifying. Obviously,
give me the cliff notes of the first 24. DC gets hit, what happens?
Is
North Korea completely off the map? Like are we just fuck, is it just,
oh, I mean, we would launch a counterattack for sure, but the counterattack, the trajectory of the missiles would go over the top of the world, and they'd have to go over Russia first to get there. And if Russia sees on their satellite that we launched a bunch of nukes and we can't get in touch with them to let them know what's going on, it's like the way she plays out the scenario is insane. I don't even want to say anymore.
Holy shit.
So A is a absolutely compelling read. Like, it's in a 12-hour audiobook, and I could not stop listening. Like, every opportunity I had, I was listening because I was like, I want to know what happens next. Like, this is crazy. It's depressing also. Obviously, heavy topic. The annihilation of humanity. It can weigh on you.
Speaking of M on the mass casualty event, I mean, that's hot right now. M's hot right now.
But part of the reason I wanted to read it was not only that I saw it pop up and I heard good things and all this stuff, and it's a topic that interests me, is I had read, I don't know if this is just a rumor or confirmed, but it sounds like Denis Villeneuve, after Dune Messiah, this is going to be the basis for his next project. So if they somehow turn this into a narrative, or if he tells this story like almost in real time, it would be nuts.
A nuclear war movie with
Denis Villeneuve,
Craig Frazier as the DP.
I know, just
and none other
crazy
than Timothy Chalamet as the president of the United States of America.
Yeah.
Oh my God, with his dumb hair and his stupid face.
So nuclear war, a scenario. Definitely recommend.
Love that. This week, we're not going to do in the news. We're going to go right to our interview. So here is our interview with Michael Luke Litwack.
Please welcome to the show the writer and director of Molly and Max in the Future, Michael Luke Litwack. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So we are going to dive into the movie quite a bit, but I'd love to know first more about sort of where you came from and your journey in the industry. Like, I saw on your website a lot of commercials, a lot of shorts, now, you know, a feature. Like, what was that trajectory like?
Yeah, I grew up in Los Angeles, and I kind of, you know, knew from a very young age that I wanted to make movies, and I kind of just started making dumb sketch videos with my friends in my backyard, and there were a couple of like class assignments where I just volunteered to make a movie instead of doing like a book report or something, and the teachers were encouraging and into it, and so it kind of just evolved from there, and I knew I wanted to go to film school, and I grew up in Los Angeles, so I kind of wanted something different. And my dad's originally from New York. He grew up in Queens. And so I'd spent time kind of a little bit in New York growing up. And so I moved to New York to go to NYU. And, you know, I kind of grew up watching big budget action adventure spectacle films like Star Wars and Indiana Jones and Jurassic Park. And that was kind of really what got me into filmmaking in the first place. And then as I kind of got older and became a teenager or young adult, like, I found myself kind of gravitating towards a new type of movie, which was like the relationship comedy, you know, Annie Hall or Amelie, or, you know, stuff that's a little bit more character driven. That's a little bit more about, you know, people in New York complaining about their therapists and, you know, just, kind of real people dealing with normal problems. And even if it's like stylized, or like a specific voice, but, you know, stuff that kind of takes place in reality for the most part, even if there's some imagination. And then, so I moved to New York to go to NYU and just started making short films. And I kind of realized in the process of just making stuff that, you know, I wanted to tell stories that were kind of similar to what got me into filmmaking in the first place, but also kind of true to, you know, what kept me in filmmaking and showed that other kind of side of the movies. And so I made some shorts. I had my NYU thesis film. That is like kind of what got me an agent and a manager. And then I kind of spent 7 years like toiling in the deserts of Hollywood development and sold some scripts, like set up some pilots, did a couple writing deals, which was fun. But ultimately, you know, I just kind of was in this endless kind of cycle of waiting and trying to get projects made, and everybody kind of deals with that to a certain degree. But I finally thought that I had, you know, I had another movie that I'd written, and we started putting it together, and it was, you know, six or seven years in the making, and it looked like it was going to happen. And then the pandemic came, and it just completely killed all of the momentum. And, you know, I kind of was at back at square one. And I realized, you know, I just wanted to write something small that I knew I could make with my friends. And that was purely kind of character driven. And I rewatched When Harry Met Sally, and it's such a perfect film. And it's crazy because it's just two people in a room talking to one another. And I've never really kind of thought of myself as someone who wants to make like mumblecore movies, which is usually that's like kind of one of the defining characteristics of them. But I think when Harry Met Sally, like it moves at such an amazing pace. It has such great characters, and you really believe that they kind of belong together at the end of it. And I think that is like the mark of a really great rom-com. And so I saw that and I was like, oh, I could make this movie on my own, but how would I want to make this movie, and how can I update it for today and talk about the things that are relevant and update some of the questions? Because the, you know, the idea of like, can men and women really be friends? Like, just doesn't really feel like that relevant anymore. And so I was like, well, you know, what is going on in the world? How do I kind of take, you know, what I'm feeling and also incorporate and talk about things that the original doesn't talk about, whether it's like the way that your career kind of factors into your identity, kind of having to find this work-life balance, you know, toxic masculinity, or like, you know, new age kind of, you know, philosophy and you know, all of these kinds of things that feel like a part of modern life, but I haven't necessarily like seen in a romantic comedy. So yeah, it kind of all kind of came from that.
It's funny you brought up Annie Hall and When Harry Met Sally, because my question, very good segue, is I got a ton of Wes Anderson, Rob Reiner, Woody Allen vibes from Max and Molly. Who are some of your favorite directors or biggest inspirations?
Yeah, I mean, I love Richard Linklater. I love Wes Anderson. I love Michel Gondry. You know, I love Jean-Pierre Jeunet. To me, like what makes them all so special is that they kind of have a view of the world that feels, they're kind of in awe of the majesty and the magic of being alive, but also like very much acknowledge the kind of bullshit of being alive. And, you know, that, and I think they all kind of filter it through their unique voice. And, so I, you know, was really inspired by all of them in different ways. And I really like, I love the visuals of Wes Anderson. I think, you know, Rushmore is one of my favorite movies of all time. And I mean, that's his like, you know, that probably doesn't have as much of his visual signature as some of his other films do. But, you know, I love colors. I love, you know, symmetrical framing. You know, I think part of finding your own voice as an artist is figuring out what are the things that you love and then kind of finding where they overlap. And if you take too much from one person, then you're going to be copying them. But if you can take a little bit from 10 or 15 different places, then it's going to create something new and unique.
How long did it take you to write the script? You know, you said you started working on the writing after pandemic or during pandemic. How long did it take to come together?
Yeah, I the writing took about 3 to 4 months for the first couple of drafts. And then, you know, it was kind of a non-traditional production process because normally you write the script and then you shoot it and then you edit it afterwards and you do all the VFX as like the second to last thing before like, you know, color and sound design. And with this, it was, I wrote the script while kind of researching how I was going to do the VFX. And then we spent 18 months kind of building out the worlds of the visual effects. And then, you know, part of it was, you know, there's like a location called the Quantum Zone. And it was like, I know that at this point in the story, this character kind of goes there because he's depressed. And, you know, how do we show depression visually? And, you know, is it a black void? Is it a white void? You know, there's lots of different ways that people can kind of show that feeling. But part of it was, you know, researching, you know, and stumbling kind of upon these M.C. Escher drawings that of these like stairways to nowhere. And suddenly it was an epiphany of like, oh, that's what this location should look like. And so then, you know, once you know what it looks like, you go back and you do another draft, you kind of rewrite it slightly. And so it was kind of this back and forth over those 18 months, but the vast majority of it, like I'd say the first 80 to 90% was done in like 3 to 4 months. But I do believe like that in the 80-20 rule, where like that last 20% is takes the longest and is the hardest, and so many of the details kind of come together in that. So, you know, one thing that was interesting that I thought was interesting was that, you know, the final script was 105 pages and the movie's 93 minutes. But then when you type up a transcript of the movie, it's actually 120 pages. And so, you know, part of when I'm working with actors is trying to get them to loosen up, trying to get it to feel natural, not having them, you know, I put a lot of energy and effort into writing the scenes and making sure that they it's not completely improvised, but I love collaborating with actors to bring something to life and then have them make it their own and have them talk over one another or, you know, customize it or add in, you know, an additional response. And so, you know, there's all these ums, whats, and ohs, and, you know, things where they're kind of just naturally reacting to one another that I think really helps it kind of have this sense of naturalism within this kind of insane over the top world.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite things about it.
Yeah, I was gonna say, how do you pitch a movie like this? I mean, on paper, it's fucking absurd. So, like, how do you get, like, a, you know, studio execs or producers to be like, this is my vision? I know, like, you're going to read it and it's amazing, but, like, how do you, like, what's your elevator pitch when you walk into a room to have people be like, oh, okay, I get what he's doing here?
Well, the short answer is that it's not a studio movie and that it's an independent film. So I only really had to convince the people that were investing in the project to be a part of it. And so we had 11 independent equity investors, and I was one of them. My wife was one of them. You know, like half the people that were in main roles, production roles on the movie were also investors in the film. And so, and a lot of them were people that I had worked with before. And so they'd seen my shorts. They kind of had developed trust with them. But, you know, the fastest way to describe it to people was that it was When Harry Met Sally in Space. And, you know, when you're coming up with an idea and you're finding the form of it, you naturally just kind of talk to your friends and family about it. And, you know, there are times where I was like, well, it's, you know, the story of this guy who does this, or it's the story of this like woman who does this. And then 10 years later, blah, 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 blah. And then like eventually the more and more you talk about it with people, you kind of simplify or you learn how to talk about it. And then there was one day where I was like, oh yeah, it's basically When Harry Met Sally in Space. And then like you see people's eyes light up and you're like, oh, that gets through to people. People know what I mean when I say that, and they can see, you know, it's just much easier to understand if they have something to kind of compare it to. So that was like a big breakthrough moment. And I mean, the structure is very, you know, it's like the timeline of the times you meet them over the course of their lives does line up to a certain degree with When Harry Met Sally. So I'm very much like proud of that comparison. And I think it makes sense. I'm happy to, you know, to be name dropping it. Yeah, yeah.
Switching to the cast for a minute, Zasha was a great get. So was Aristotle. What was the casting process like?
So Zasha had, her husband had worked with my wife on a project. My wife's an editor and, he's a producer and also an actor. And, so they were kind of friendly acquaintances. And then she had also acted in a friend of mine's movie, Sophie Brooks. And, Sophie just had like amazing things to say about her. And, I'd been familiar with her work from Girls and The Flight Attendant. And she just has like years of really great, amazing comedic material under her belt. You know, I wrote the script, not with a specific actress in mind, but as soon as kind of her name came up, I was like, oh my God, yes, she would be amazing. And we'd be so lucky to have her. And so, you know, we sent it to her, and some actors, they just want to work on cool stuff and they aren't scared away if it's too small. But I also like, you know, we had a little bit of a previous relationship, and then, I had the shorts that kind of showed the proof of concept of like, I can work in this style and you're reading a script with all this insane stuff, but I have a plan for how I'm going to actually pull it off. And so she came on board I was just super excited about that. And then Aristotle was on SNL that season, when I had heard, like, my casting director, put him, sent me his stuff, and he has, you know, a long career as a stand-up comedian behind him, and he also worked in a really great sketch group. And so he just had this really versatile range where he can do these insanely specific characters, but then he also just kind of has this natural calmness and presence to him that, you know, it wasn't something that I necessarily like consciously realized until we were there, but I was like, it ended up being just this really nice compliment to Zasha's, like, she has an inherent talent for kind of neurotic characters. And I think Ari has this kind of natural calmness and oddness to him, but it really kind of complemented her energy. Because I think that's one of the hardest things of like casting a rom-com. And, you know, they're both established enough and the movie was so small that like we can't really ask them to read the script or do an audition because they're established actors. And so you kind of have to take this leap of faith on people. And I think in a rom-com, you want them to be similar enough that you believe that they're together, but different enough that there's enough conflict and enough tension between them so that you, when they do come together, you believe it and it feels earned, but it isn't just that they're the exact same person.
And a fast follow to that, was Oak instantly on board when you told him he'd be a floating sex addicted demigod, or did you have to sell him on kind of what that part was?
You know, it was so funny because like I put together this pitch book that explained, you know, this is how we're, because we had been spending months putting together all the materials and you know, doing all this visual effects work beforehand, we had some examples of stuff that we could show to actors to convince them. And I was expecting to go into these meetings and really like be grilled on like how I was going to do things. And like nobody asked anything. And maybe it was just because the pitch book was good enough. But I had met Oak and we had talked about him working in a different project of mine. And so like, again, we kind of had that previous relationship and that project didn't come to fruition, but we kind of had a shorthand. And again, it's like some actors, especially New York actors, like if some of them just want to work on cool stuff. And if you can put a script in front of them that they like, then they're on board. And others, you know, they care more about how much, you know, they're in a different stage of their life where money is the main priority, which I completely understand, or, you know, they're trying to only do a franchise movie or something like that. And so it's so much of it is just kind of about timing, but, you know, I just felt very lucky that he was so game to be this tentacle monster.
That's awesome.
Yeah, he was great.
I have a kind of a random script question, but you created so much like jargon for the movie and silly stuff. Like the bargle.com line is my favorite line in the movie. How did you come up with some of these like words and phrases? It, like glorp, like, is it just, did it come to you? Is there any like influence, rhyme or reason to it?
There isn't really any method, you know, like I read a book a while ago that was, I forget the name of it, but it was talking about like absurdism and language. And it was talking about how like Lewis Carroll has all these like made up words. And if you look at them, if you look at all the made up words that Lewis Carroll made, there's like a lot of similarities and you can tell when it's kind of a Lewis Carroll made up word versus like a Dr. Seuss made up word. And I think it's just like a subconscious thing that kind of bubbles up and glorp just sounds kind of gross, but it also sounds a little bit like glug, glug, glug. And, you know, so that was just, you know, I kind of just pulled them out of my ass.
that's so well, great.
You know what? I was a huge fan of Futurama growing up, and a lot of it reminded me of like Slurm, yeah, and some of the things they use there. And like, I thought it was a really cool kind of, maybe it was a nod to that, or like it was maybe subconscious in the back of your mind, but I thought it was really funny how there was like a kind of a connection there.
Definitely. No, I mean, I grew up watching Futurama and I love Futurama, but I hadn't seen it in like 10 or 15 years. And we went, yeah, and shot the whole movie and I showed it to a friend and they're like, oh, so glorp, it's like Slurm, right? And I was like, what? And he's like, it's like Slurm. And I was like, oh my God, wait, did I just, and then I like looked it up and I was like, oh, it is like Slurm. So it definitely was a subconscious pull. But
that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's great.
One of my favorite parts of the movie is the musical choice, like the choice to make it not sound like Blade Runner, you know, and using pianos and jazzy sort of like very organic, like very real, like musicians in a room type music for most of it. Like what was, I mean, Yeah, just like how'd you arrive at that? Like you would think you're making a hyper futuristic movie, you'd go with hyper futuristic, you know, music.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's always been about the idea of combining a romantic comedy and putting it in a world that you haven't seen before, and kind of making a movie that exists like clearly within that genre, but then kind of is a fresh twist on it. And you know, there's a old animated show called Cowboy Bebop that a lot of people really love, and that has jazz and space. And I remember watching that and just being like, oh my God, it's such a cool combination. And then, you know, when you look at When Harry Met Sally or Annie Hall, like jazz music is just such a huge part of the New York City rom-com. And so to me, it was like a very kind of obvious choice of like, well, that's the thing that's going to make it feel the most like a rom-com. And it will, I think music can really tell people how to feel in a way that can be very helpful. And sometimes can, if you do it wrong, can be very distracting. But, you know, I think it sets an expectation with the audience of like, oh, this is what this movie is. And as soon as people kind of hear that jazz in the first 5 minutes, their mind comes around to, I'm not going to expect explosions from this movie. This is a movie about two people talking to each other. And then when we have some giant robots fighting, it's a nice little surprise.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. No, it's one of the first things that grabbed me when I was watching it is that like juxtaposition.
Yeah. Our composer, Alex Winkler, was really amazing. And he, you know, it was such a small movie that I didn't think that we were going to be able to get a completely original score. So I originally talked to him and I was like, you know, if you can make half the music that we need, then like maybe we can just use kind of like stock music for some of the less important scenes. And he was just like, no, I'm doing it all. And wow. Made a fully original soundtrack, which is all on Spotify. And he's a wizard.
When, you know, you mentioned the mech fighting, to go back to the production for a minute, I had another question about all the different sort of forms of media. It seemed like there was some stop motion, or it seemed like there's miniatures based on like the post credits, like behind the scenes. Like, how did you come to which technique you're going to use for what? Or was that planned out, or was that more like figure it out when you got to production?
No, everything was planned out like very, very far in advance. And so, you know, I use a 3D storyboarding app called Previs Pro, and that allows me to kind of put a digital camera in 3D space and see exactly how far I need, because our studio space was so small and everything was so cramped that we had to plan out like every inch of everything. And so, you know, in the bloopers, you see we used kind of rear screen projection on inside the studio, in addition to like an LED stage for the first week. And it was like, if you turn the camera like 1 foot to the right or 1 foot to the left, you're seeing off the stage. And so often it was like we kind of kept the camera in the same place and then had to move everything else around that. And sometimes we would change the height or something, but it was very constricted. So we really needed to plan everything. And then on top of that, you know, me and Zach, the director of photography, we did all the visual effects from start to finish for like 90 to 95% of the movie. And so, you know, Zach has a little bit more of a VFX background than I do, and he was able to come up with some systems, but I, you know, am mostly self-taught and learned how to do this stuff just by watching YouTube videos, and I'm not a professional VFX artist. So a lot of that research and that rewriting process was like, okay, I have an idea for how I could do this, but I'm not going to write this into the script unless I know for a fact how we're going to pull this off, because I can't just kick that can down the road and be like, here, go figure it out, because I'm going to be the person that has to figure it out. And so, so much of it was just like, well, what's possible? And, you know, with the quantum zone, it was like, well, okay, we know we need this place to represent depression. We like this M.C. Escher thing. Can I find a bunch of miniature dollhouse staircases for under $50? And so then it was like, oh, once I found those on Amazon, I was like, all right, we're off to the races. Like, that's what this is going to look like. And then, you know, that it was a similar thing for all of the different locations, where it was like, I want this, I think the scene should be inside their apartments, but if we can't build a miniature apartment, then how are we going to do that? Because we can't build a full-size apartment. And so I went and found some model kits from like Wargaming sets and contacted the people who made them, and they gave me permission to use them in the background of the film. And so then we shot those, and then that was what we put behind the actors. And so
that's wild.
Thanks.
Wow, man.
I also noticed some of the smaller touches, like in Zasha's apartment, there was like a book like in the foreground that was like Eat, Pray, Triangulon.
Yeah, I mean, that was the lovely part of like having this really extended prep time was like my wife designed all those book covers. And, you know, that was something where it was like, I just, you know, we built these miniature cities and then we needed logos for them. And that was actually their like one of the origins of Glorp was that I was like, well, what's the Coca-Cola? Because if you go to Times Square, there's going to be a Coca-Cola ad there. And so it was like, well, what's this universe's Coca-Cola? It's going to be Glorp. And then I was like, oh, well, in the script, he needs to sell out and become a corporate shill. He might as well be promoting that product. And then we can also have that on his, you know, on his jacket. And like, you know, so it was this really fun kind of thing where it was like, oh, let's just come up with a world building detail. And then, oh, how do we integrate that into the story and make it a bigger part? Or, you know, we know that like you don't really ever get to see the books on someone's shelf inside Blade Runner, but like there's a pretty decent chance that we're going to see some books on people's shelves in this movie, because this is the type of movie where we're sitting on people's couches and what do people have on their coffee table? They're going to have books. And so let's come up with what those books are. And then if someone watches it and finds it, like sees it on their second viewing, like that's a great little fun Easter egg.
Okay, so with an indie movie like yours, what's the plan after post? Like, is it like, let's go the festival circuit and then hopefully cross our fingers we get distribution? Or is it kind of like, hey, I made this, it was a passion project, I love what I did, let's see how people love it and whatever happens happens?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think you need to go into it with kind of the latter attitude of like not really having any expectations of distribution and being ready to kind of self-distribute it if you need to. But we were very lucky. I mean, we got into South by Southwest and we premiered there, and then we had a really great year of festival runs. But at South by Southwest, we had a distributor who came to the screening and really enjoyed the film, and we got a couple offers for distribution out of the festival. And so, you know, I kind of tried to go into it. You know, I have a lot of friends that are indie filmmakers, and it's really, really hard to get distribution, even if you play at a major film festival. And so most movies go kind of straight to video on demand or are self-distributed or some combination of the two. And so we found this distributor who wanted to put it in theaters, which was something that I never even really expected. And it was really, really great. I mean, we got into 40 movie theaters across the country and played for, you know, a week in New York and LA. And, you know, over the course of February and March, it played at a bunch of different places. And so, you know, it allowed us to get so much more exposure. It allowed a lot of audiences to see it on the big screen, which is always really, really fun. And then after that, the distribution company also helps kind of place it on, you know, video on demand and iTunes and Apple and Amazon. And so it's been kind of fun to have these different waves of people that, like, you know, we premiered 13 months ago at South by Southwest, and we had 20 of the cast and crew that were out there, which was almost every single person that worked on the project was at the South by Southwest premiere. And then, you know, we got to have our New York City premiere where a bunch of my New York friends got to see it. And then now it's finally on video on demand. And like my friend who lives in San Francisco, where we couldn't get a theater, like, you know, texted me yesterday and said that he finally got to see it. So it's really nice to kind of get the different waves of people discovering it. And now it's like finally kind of available for everybody everywhere.
Yeah. What is the best way for our audience or anybody out there to watch it? What's the best way to watch it in a way that supports you?
Honestly, any of the VOD platforms, I actually don't know if one of them we make more money off of than the other. I think they're all basically the same. But, you know, it's on Amazon, it's on iTunes, it's on you know, Vudu and, you know, anywhere that you can buy movies, it is there. So honestly, buying it or renting it. And, you know, we also have a merch store, that has some fun merch too.
That's so great. What's next? What are you working on now? What do you want to be working on? All of the things.
Yeah, I have a new movie. It's like a sci-fi Western. So I'm really excited about that, but it's much bigger and it's going to require a lot more money than Molly and Max. So, you know, we're playing the waiting game and sending it to people and trying to put it together. And, you know, at the same time, I'm writing new things. So I really hope that this is my next film. But if I've learned anything, it's kind of that some of this stuff is out of your control and you do everything you can. But you kind of have to keep on creating new things and making your own kind of opportunities. So I want to write something that is, smaller and makeable at the same time while I'm trying to kind of get this next bigger movie made. And maybe I'll get this next big one made, or maybe that I'll have to wait 10 years to do that. But we'll see.
Well, once you experience the Should I Go See It podcast bump, I'm sure the financing will be no problem.
Yeah, it'll be there.
This podcast is just like exclusively distributed to people who have $1 billion and higher, yeah. Right? Good. That's what I've heard.
Right.
One other question I want to ask before we let you go. This has been a common theme on the show, but AJ here has not seen Michael Mann's seminal classic Heat. And I was curious why, if you could pitch it, why do you think AJ should finally watch Heat?
I honestly barely remember. The movie.
Darn it.
So I might be more on the side of like, you know, it's sometimes fun to have like a stubborn movie that you haven't seen.
Yeah.
You
know? Like, well, he's stubborn. All right.
I know a person who hasn't seen Star Wars and they love to talk about it. And, you know, I don't think they ever are going to see it because it makes them just a little bit more interesting. So I think you should hold out. Never watch
no.
it.
And,
I, you know what?
And on your gravestone, it can say, AJ, never seen
it.
Bill's now over to one of these days asking people. He asked Maria the same thing.
She hasn't seen it.
She was like, nah, I haven't even seen it. Why should he see it? So
kills
yeah,
me.
We're in a
kills
good spot me. Here. Well, I'm going to go to the grave, never watching Michael Mann's seminal classic. Oh,
devastating.
Thanks, Michael. So really appreciate that one.
Anytime.
Cool. Well, thank you again so much for coming on and chatting with us. It was great to meet you and great to learn more about the movie.
Thank you for having me. I had a really good time.
Nice.
And thanks for spreading the word about the film. I really appreciate it.
Oh, for sure. No, we loved it.
Well, I hope you all loved our interview with Michael Luke Litwack. Again, Molly and Max in the Future is streaming on all VOD platforms now. So make sure you either rent or buy and show your support because the film is awesome. All right, Bill, let's wrap it up. Okay. Netflix and Bill, what are we watching?
Jumping back to the Armageddon subject from the top of the show, I love did that. Start watching Fallout, the new Amazon Prime series based on the Fallout video games.
Huge fan.
They released all 8 episodes at once, which is a rare move for Amazon, but I'm through the first 4.
Whoa.
And it's good. It's really good. I think that Walton Goggins is phenomenal, as always. And the tone of the show, the extreme violence, but like the wink and comedy element of it, and the music from the 50s. Like, I never played the video games, full disclosure, but I know of them. I know some of the iconography of the shows and games, excuse me. I know of them, and it feels like this is doing a good job translating what I know. Story-wise, I have no idea if it's close to the games at all. But as a show, I'm definitely enjoying it. I'll definitely finish it.
First of all, after the 1K event, go on to Xbox. It's part of Game Pass. Download Fallout 3 and play Fallout 3 because Fallout 3, Fallout 4, I mean, they're some of the best games you'll ever play ever. New Vegas is fantastic. I'm a huge fan of the games. I've played most of them. I cannot wait to watch the show. And it seems like all the things that you're saying, like the hyperviolence mixed with the comedy and this like 1950s kind of like nuclear family type approach seems exactly what is on brand for them. So I am very, very excited to watch this.
Which game was the Boston-based one? There is one that was in Massachusetts, wasn't it?
Was that 3 or 4? It was Fallout 3, and then it was New Vegas, and then it was 4. 4 took place in Boston.
Which was cool.
And
they all have their
different... Yeah, they have their different kind of like... I mean, it's all the same universe, right? It happened after the nuclear war. So like Vegas definitely has its Vegas theme. 3 is in D.C., so like the areas around Washington, the swamps, like it's cool. And then 4 was in Boston. So like after the bombs went off, there's kind of like this new revolution thing that goes on. So there's a whole bunch of like revolutionary tie-ins. Fenway Park becomes this kind of like massive hub for all of the wanderers in the wasteland.
Oh, that's cool.
They did
cool.
a really cool job of like having Fenway be the hub where you can like upgrade your gear and like take on new missions and stuff like that. It was, and then there's like all these bunch of side quests where like you have to figure out like witches and ghouls and Salem and stuff like that. And they did a fucking awesome job with it.
Okay, all right, maybe I'll get around to those. But yeah, the show's strong.
Can't wait. I don't know 72. Well, no, I watched all practice rounds and the par 3 competition. So I watched like, I don't know, 300 hours of golf last week, and it was
just indented in the couch there.
Fucking awesome. Well, I moved my desk where you can't see it because we're audio only situation. I moved my desk around, so I had two monitors. I had my iPad, and then I have a 50-inch LG on the wall too. So yep. I had full coverage of all my guys. I was following just fucking.
Are there different streams for like different things? Dude. Or you're not just watching the straight broadcast?
Can I go off on a second?
Please.
The Masters is one of the biggest sporting events in the world, right? Their TV coverage and the way they do the fucking broadcast is fucking abysmal. Abysmal.
Really?
Because Augusta has these weird rights around usage and who has the ability. So, I mean, guys tee off at 9 a.m. You can only follow certain groups on the Masters app or on ESPN Plus or like Paramount and Peacock up until 3 o'clock. And then the Masters app, which is the best app for sports in the entire world, picks up the full range of the entire broadcast from 3 on. And that's the same thing through the entire weekend until Saturday at 3 and then Sunday at 2, CBS Jim Nance picks up the national broadcast. Right. So you're watching it on 3 different or 4 different streaming services up until, you know, Saturday afternoon or Sunday afternoon to kind of figure out what's going on. It's the dumbest thing in the entire world.
And then you got to have a separate screen for your DraftKings and your bank account and just watch those fluctuate.
Two lines moving in different directions.
Yeah. I got a line to my marker person in Vegas to make sure, you know, things are going well.
Do you do the green visor, or do you find that that's not necessary if you're inside?
No. The don't need the visor. That's for Cashmere Keith. I'm just, you know, rocking myself. Just gross sweatpants and food on my shirt, just like any other God-fearing American.
And how was this year's competition?
I mean, Scottie Scheffler.
Entertaining? Pleased with it?
I mean, he's the best golfer since Tiger Woods.
Wow.
So second jacket in 3 years. His wife was pregnant. People thought that he said if his wife Meredith went into labor with her first child, he would leave. But she did not go into labor. And he, you know, he won 3 or 4 strokes on second place and almost up 7 strokes on the person in third place. So it was a beat
domination.
Down. Good guy. Loves Chipotle. Loves God. Loves Texas. I mean, he's just, you know, you're all American.
Swings him straight.
Red meat kind of guy. So yeah, it was good. Now my eyes need a detox from that. But you know, every time you hear Hello Friends from Jim Nance, just hits you in the feels. You know,
it's special. I mean, I don't watch golf ever, but I do.
You were texting me.
I do watch the last day of the Masters. Yeah,
I was your unofficial Tiger tracker. You're like, did he make the cut? How's he playing? Is he wearing his red? What's his outfit?
That's what I'm always curious about, because I don't watch golf really much anymore, but I grew up watching golf. I grew up watching Tiger on wearing red on Sundays. Like, he inspired a generation. Obviously, I'm one of those people.
Yeah.
So. I do pay attention to that.
He now holds a record for most consecutive cuts, but his body ain't working anymore, folks. He's a broken man.
Yeah. It's too bad.
Been through a lot. Yeah. Bill?
Yep.
Take us away.
Thank you for listening to the Should I Go See It podcast. Please make sure to follow on Instagram @ Should I Go See It.